Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll hear stories about holiday traditions that have been passed down through several generations. We'll travel to a toy making workshop where toys are handmade, similar to what your grandparents might remember from Christmas past.
Can you remember before Walmart and plastics? There wasn't necessarily a store to go to buy toys. So grandmom or granddad or dad or mom made the toys from what was readily available.
And while not everyone loves Christmas carols, we'll meet some animals who have a particular fondness for Christmas carols being played from a church organ.
Sometimes if the door's open, if they're outside, you can see them, they'll just lift their ears up like they're trying to catch more of the sound of the organ.
And we'll hear why some farmers who grow Christmas trees are closing up shop.
Unfortunately, everybody's like me, they're getting old and they're going out of business. And it's really happened the last 5 or 6 years.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. I'm not going to lie, this time of year can be stressful for me. And when you think about all that stuff we accumulate, including all that paper and plastic, sometimes I just wish gift giving could be simpler. Like back in years past, if money were tight, I hear older folks talk about how their family would just exchange a few simple gifts. I mean, just think, even something as simple as an orange at Christmas was a welcome treat 80 years ago. Today, toys are a big business across the country. Even though many big brick-and-mortar stores like Toys R Us are going out of business, Americans buy billions of dollars worth of toys each year. Most of the toys we buy are made in China. And while video games are expected to increase in popularity, a different trend in toys is also on the rise. Eco-friendly toys made of a few basic materials and no plastic. There are still businesses here in Appalachia that make those old-time wooden toys. Our Folkways reporter Zach Harold visited the Mountain Craft Shop Company in Wetzel County, West Virginia, where they still make handcrafted toys the old-fashioned way.
When I was a kid, the thing that intrigued me most about Santa wasn't the beard, or the flying reindeer, or the repeated breaking and entering. No, I was fascinated by his workshop. I love to imagine elves working tirelessly on toys that would end up under Christmas trees around the world, but you know, I never once imagined them making the season's hottest toys. Instead, I pictured Santa's little helpers building toys with good old-fashioned wood and glue. I imagined a shop filled with the smell of sawdust and the sound of pop guns. Turns out, my visions looked a lot like what I found in Proctor, West Virginia, the headquarters of the Mountain Craft Shop Company, which has been turning out traditional handmade Appalachian folk toys since the early 1960s. The tree-shaded workshop used to be an elementary school. Now, one side of the building is filled with power saws and a wood lathe, bottles of Elmer's glue, and slabs of locally sourced hardwood. The other side, the shop showroom, is filled with toys your great-grandparents would probably recognize.
I like to tell the kids, you know, can you remember before Walmart and plastics? And there wasn't necessarily a store to go to buy toys. So grandmom or granddad or dad or mom made the toys from what was readily available. Sticks that they found out back, little pieces of wood, pieces of string, little bits of leather.
That's Steve Conlon, who runs the business with his wife Ellie. A few months back, he gave me a tour of the property, which he calls Wetzel County's only amusement park. Putting down his pop gun, Conlon picks up a toy shaped like a capital letter L. He holds it by the short end and whips it around in the air.
We call this a rattle trap, and all this noise is generated from a tongue depressor and this little cogged wheel here. I tell them it sounds better in a van.
Then he picks up that old toy where you try to catch a ball on a string in a cup.
And this actually dates back to 1580 in England. good for eye-hand coordination.
How long did it take you to get it on the third try?
I should be able to get it on the first try.
Next, he moves over to a low table and palms a handful of marbles, manufactured about 20 miles away at the Marble King factory in Payton City.
We make a variety of marble toys. And this one is interesting. We call it a musical marble tree. It's about 30 inches tall, and it has pieces of wood, leaves, that stick out on either side. So there's 30 leaves up and down this tree, and we drop a marble, and the marbles go from one leaf to the next leaf. Makes a wonderful noise, don't you think?
The Conlins make all these toys, and dozens more models, in their tiny shop, which is open to visitors. They also sell their toys in gift shops around West Virginia and surrounding states, and at Tamarack in Beckley. But they did not come to West Virginia to be toy makers. They wanted to be farmers.
Well, we moved here in 1974 from Philadelphia, and we brought with us a couple beehives in the back of the U-Haul truck, and I was just fascinated with bees, and we tried chickens and cows and every other agricultural pursuit, and bees kept kind of rising to the top. So it evolved into us owning a lot of beehives and needing other locations to keep them.
They placed some of their hives on the property of a neighbor named Dick Shinaki. He was a mechanical engineer by trade and worked at the aluminum plant in nearby New Martinsville. But he also taught himself to make traditional folk toys. Research wasn't easy, though.
But very little was really recorded.
This is Shinaki appearing on a West Virginia Department of Culture and History television program back in 1978.
You see, toys were not considered to be anything but trifles all through the ages until just the last few years.
Still, Shinaki forged ahead. He eventually compiled two books on folk toys. He also spun his passion into a small business, the Mountain Craft Shop Company. Shinaki handled all the research, development, marketing, and sales, but, kind of like Kris Kringle himself, turned manufacturing over to a team of elves. Again, here's Steve Conlin.
He actually didn't make any of the toys himself, but he had probably 10 people who were making the different toys at home, people who were buying their farm by making toys to be sold.
Through the years, Shinaki grew the company's inventory to include more than 200 traditional toys. But by 2002, he was getting older and looking to get out of the toy business. So he sold the Mountain Craft Shop Company to an enterprising couple who could keep his legacy alive, his friends the Conlins. Along with the business, the Conlins also got Shinaki's expertise on building folk toys.
It was a manufacturing business and had to learn how to manufacture those toys and had to accumulate a lot of power tools, that wasn't painful for a man to do.
To keep manufacturing costs low, they decided to start making most of the toys in-house. The Conlins, who still raise bees and sell honey, get the wood for the toys from trees they harvest on their own property or from logs their neighbors give them. They mill the logs themselves and air-dry the lumber in the shop.
Some woods do a lot better at certain things. So, yeah, we kind of pick out the woods for their adaptability to the product and also to the beauty. You know, if you use a piece of walnut in a toy, you know, it really makes it stand out. Or if you use some cherry, when I'm turning things on the lathe, cherry is a very nice wood for turning. So we use cherry if we're turning.
Many of the toys are incredibly labor-intensive to produce. Take the Jacob's Ladder, for instance. This classic, deceptively simple-looking toy creates the illusion that pieces are click-clacking their way to the bottom of a string of wooden tiles.
Yeah, the Jacob's Ladder has 8 different pieces of wood. So I make the pieces of wood in here, plane them down, sand them.
Steve Conlin's wife Ellie cuts 24 pieces of fabric and then glues those to the wooden tiles to bring the Jacob's Ladder together.
We sell about 1,000 a year, so not too many people want to work for pennies on the hour. If you own your own business, you do that.
That level of commitment and sacrifice is one reason the Conlins are not yet sure who will take over the Mountain Craft Shop Company when they decide to retire.
How will it play out? We don't know yet. I mean, this is the reality of the situation is that we are manufacturing in America. Look around you. Manufacturing in America is, there's a lot of competition.
One thing remains certain, though. The traditional toys the Conlins make have not lost their ability to captivate children. They see it every time they set up a booth at a craft fair.
And kids will just spend minutes out, half an hour there, as long as the parents are willing to stay. And then, of course, there's crying and screaming when it's time to leave. And the savvy parents say, okay, it's now it's time for ice cream. And the kids go, okay.
When Steve says this, it reminds me of something that happened a few months ago when my wife and I took our 5-year-old little girl to Babcock State Park in southern West Virginia. We told her she could pick out one thing from the gift shop. She perused the whole store but ultimately gravitated toward a shelf near the window where she picked up a Jacob's Ladder made by the Conlins. As we cruised down the interstate headed for home, I noticed I couldn't hear any noise coming from her tablet. Instead, I heard this. Even in this age of screens, toys made of wood and glue still contain some magic. Steve and Ellie Conlin are keeping that magic alive. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Zach Harold in Santa's Workshop. I mean, Proctor, West Virginia.
You can see Steve and Ellie Conlin making toys at their workshop. They're open year-round, including the weekend before Christmas. We've posted details and their holiday hours on our website, wvpublic.org. We also posted a video that takes you inside the Mountain Crafts shop in Wetzel County, West Virginia. This story is part of our Folkways reporting project. You can hear more stories of Appalachian folklife, arts, and culture on our website at wvpublic.org/insideappalachia. There you can also subscribe to the podcast or find the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
At Grandma's house, it's a Christmas sight. The porch would glow with the red and green.
The holidays are usually a time to be around family and friends, but when the loved ones who helped introduce you to the traditions are gone, the heartache can be particularly intense. For me, things just aren't the same without Meemaw sharing her home with baked goodies or Pawpaw reading the story about the birth of Jesus from the Bible. But I enjoy the opportunity to carry on the traditions and legacies of my family and honor their memory by doing things like setting out a ceramic church Granny and her sisters painted long ago. But of course, the holidays aren't the only time we miss those who have passed away. Reporter Molly Bourne originally sat down to write a story about missing a loved one around the holidays, but she realized that grief doesn't follow a set schedule. Here's Molly.
About 2 years ago, in early January, I recorded this totally boring thing that's happened dozens of times. My dad coming to get me at the bottom of my parents' snowy driveway, because my car couldn't make it up the hill. It was a pretty treacherous climb, even for his pickup. But it was not especially memorable or interesting. Still, I felt compelled to capture it.
Looky there.
Face down.
I didn't know if we'd do it or not.
The trees look pretty.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Let's see, I think you know this.
Good
new
job.
My dad died that September, 1 week after he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. In the summer, he had been outside like always, chopping wood and mowing grass. Soon he couldn't talk or use the bathroom by himself. I fed him Ensure. He looked like a skeleton. Decades worth of aging happened in a matter of days. I recently found the notes I took at the time. I barely remember scribbling them all down. July 2018, started feeling bad. August 12th, asked me to feel hard place on his tummy. August 15th, went to the doctor. August 23rd, got biopsy and CAT scan. August 30th, got diagnosis. Cancer in the liver, moved to the lungs, stage 4. As he declined further, we were in the car, at my urging, my mom, dad, and me, taking him to the ER. It was one of the last times we were all together as a family, and something told me to turn on a recorder. Not to preserve a memory of him, but to try to capture the sounds around me. It was all happening so fast, I worried I couldn't rely on my own memory to piece together the details. And I was working in public radio, so used to taking out my recorder.
Yes, today. Tuesday?
It's...
What's the date?
Tuesday, September 4th.
In the car, Dad and I split a cigarette.
After he lines it, you think, ask you, tell you get one of you, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's...
I'll do one or back.
Yeah, I want a hit. Or a drag. Can I borrow it?
You want quick?
Whenever you have another.
Mom was trying to keep it together.
That grass in the middle, Dawn. I'll tell you, this summer's grass has been hard to keep track of. Look over there, it's never looked like that.
In the face of loss, we're left to attach significance to the things that seemed ordinary before. Like this recording, like the snow video. It is my way of grieving, of healing. 2 days later, he was gone. The loss was swift. There wasn't even time to seriously consider options for treatment. There was talk of chemo, but everyone knew it was too late. The cancer doctor left for vacation without leaving a number to call. Dad was 67. I don't know what I thought grief would or should look like. My grandmother's was easy to identify. The intensification of pain and expressions of sadness on birthdays and anniversaries, and an inability to return to my parents' home. But mine was different. I didn't cry at his funeral. I've never been to his grave and don't care to go. I have a glass of good bourbon on his birthday and listen to the songs I played at his bedside before he died. I well up when the Navy March song comes on, even though I hardly know what my dad did during his service. I post his picture on Instagram when I think I'm supposed to, but I don't feel especially sad when I thought I would or should. My dad and I were never close. He held me at a distance his whole life, and we struggled to understand each other or to have real conversations. I'd go weeks without talking to him, but his death brought on an intimacy I didn't expect. In the weeks before he died, I took charge. I became his advocate. He needed me like I wanted him to need me his whole life. Death changed our relationship. A friend and I discussed this recently, how the things that drove us nuts about our late parents seemed forgivable now, even endearing. My dad had a $45 bill with Trump's face on it that used to incense me. I found it again recently, and I laughed. I talk about my dad and his death more than I ever did when he was alive. I talk about him to strangers, to friends. I'm less critical of his shortcomings, and it's easy for me to talk about him in conversations. Let me tell you about this hillbilly contraption my dad made to scoop up ladybugs off the ceiling. A pop bottle with the bottom cut off, taped to a paint stirrer handle. And now I surround myself with his belongings. His gun collection meant nothing to me until we were clearing it out. I gave his pistol to a dear friend, a collector himself. I gave his dresser to another friend. These things have brought my dad into my friends' lives too, and bonded them to me more securely. And on my bed is the buffalo plaid blanket we earned from carefully cutting out Marlboro Miles from hundreds of cartons of cigarettes. Those precious ordinary things that are part of my home now prove that nothing is the same and promise that it's all right that nothing's the same. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Molly Bourne.
We're going to take a quick break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
The Feast of Seven Fishes is a holiday tradition in southern Italy and in Italian-American communities across the country. In north-central West Virginia, for example, where many Italians immigrated to work in the coal mines, there is a Feast of the Seven Fishes festival held each December in Fairmont. A new movie, set just before Christmas time, features an Italian West Virginia family as they prepare for their own Feast of Seven Fishes. It's a romantic comedy based on a graphic novel. Here's a clip. In this scene, the men in the family are beginning to prepare dinner. They do all the work for the feast, including telling a young visitor to leave the kitchen.
So how long do you bake the calamari?
About an hour.
And the bacala and the whiting?
Bacala.
Bacala.
About another hour.
It's a real exact science.
I picked up one.
All right, Tony.
Yeah.
Grab some of that, there's some antipasto in the fridge. Put it on the table out there, will you? All right. So everybody listen up, okay? I want no non-essential personnel out of the damn kitchen. Not you, Carmine. That means all women, sweetheart, okay? Vince, listen to me.
Talk your head off.
I'll be fine.
All right. Put a couple of cups of flour in there, get a paper bag out the pantry, some salt and pepper. We're gonna do the smell first. Tony, here, heat up this skillet.
A lot of cooks in that kitchen. One of the producers for Feast of the Seven Fishes is Jeff Tennell. His brother Bob wrote the graphic novel that the movie is based on. The two grew up in the area where the movie was shot. Our news director, Jesse Wright, spoke with the Tennell brothers about the project.
Thanks so much for joining us, Bob and Jeff. Congrats on a great film. I mean, I watched it last night with my wife. It was absolutely heartwarming, endearing, just a great experience, and especially this time of year, you know. Bob, can you give our listeners an overview of what the film's about?
The film is an adaptation of a comic strip graphic novel that I did several years ago of the same title. It's 1983, Christmas time, on the Mon River. Basically Reevesville, Fairmont, West Virginia area. We're following the Oliverio family as they are preparing for the traditional Christmas Eve seafood feast. So there's a lot of emphasis on the food, but at the same time, we're meeting this kind of large, crazy cast of characters that are swirling around Tony Oliverio, who's a young college student who works in the family store, who has met a non-Italian girl, Beth. And one thing leads to another, and he brings her home for the feast on Christmas. And it is, it's a bit of a train wreck at that point.
I think the film does a great job of explaining it, but for those in the audience who don't know, Jeff, can you take us through the tradition of the Feast of the Seven Fishes and that the storyline is based around?
Feast of Seven Fishes is from southern Italy, where most of it comes from, in north central West Virginia, because of the coal industry, there were a lot of Italian Americans that came at the turn of the century, the 1890s, the early, really the 19-teens and that type of thing came into the area and brought a lot of the traditions from the old country with them. So it's one of those funny pieces of cultural lore, if you will. You'll talk to people. It even touches upon it in the movie when the lead character gives an explanation about what Feast of the Seven Fishes is. It's kind of like, well, I don't really know what it is. Is it the seven sacraments? Is it this? How many fish are you supposed to make? So I think it's grown over the years, and people kind of adapted the tradition for themselves. It was something when we were kids growing up, Bob and I, my mother's family was an Oliverio family, and it was something that went on. It just was Christmas Eve. We didn't call it anything. It was
no. In fact, in Italy, they call it La Vigilia. Seven Fishes is kind of an American. It always cracks me up, though. You'll hear people say there's no such thing in Italy as the Seven Fishes. It's like, really? So 2 million Southern Italians migrated to America, populated the country, and with no form of real mass communication said, I got an idea. We're going to start cooking fish on Christmas Eve. I mean, if you're talking about is it or is it not at the Feast of the Seven Fishes, you're playing a semantics game. And you're just trying to be cute. It's a very, very real thing.
I know that this is a project you've been wanting to get down for a while. What was the genesis for the film, Bob?
I'd like to tell you that when I first started videotaping my grandfather and my great uncles in the 90s cooking, that I did it with this big master plan. Not true. I just loved the food, and I loved the fellowship that we had with it, the traditions and the memories that it built, and I just want to try to preserve it. And it was almost 10 years from the time that I had videotaped them to I started writing the script that became the comic book, that became the movie script. And then we couldn't get the movie made forever. You know, I mean, I even had a manager one time said, nobody wants to hear about your stupid relatives cooking fish on Christmas Eve. No longer my manager, but it, you know, it is, I very much was driven by a desire to preserve. And I'm, and as a filmmaker, you know, I'm also interested in doing things that, that involve processes. You know, like I wanted the food and the preparation of it to be a character in the film. And it very much is. That just fascinates me. You know, it's not a plot-heavy film. I wasn't interested in making a plot-heavy film. I wanted to kind of just pick people up and dump them into the, this family's lives for about 36 hours and give them something to eat. You know?
I love those moments where you kind of almost take a pause from the plot to explain the dishes and all these variations in the tradition. Some people do this, some people do that. This is what these folks are doing. Just the way that the feel of that, you can really tell how much you guys love that that sense of place and being, you know, in that space with family.
Well, and the other thing I wanted to do, because, you know, film is changing. Our storytelling is changing. And I very much, I wanted, it's probably a stupid title, but I call it the Wiki effect. And it really first hit me. I remember I was watching Spielberg's Lincoln with my wife and daughter, and they loved the movie, but they spent the whole movie wikiing. Who was Seward? You know, who was the vice president? You know, things that, now I know a lot about the Civil War and about Lincoln, read a lot of books, and it was driving me crazy. I mean, to me, it was like somebody cussing in church. You know, it's like, why aren't you completely focused on the film? But we're changing as a society. And so when I approach this film, and I've been doing it in other work, non-feature related work, you know, in commercials or whatever, I wanted the film to be, I know that people now are used to pausing and starting and stopping. So I said, you know, when you watch this movie, if you're careful, you'll actually learn how to prepare at least seven of these dishes. And I took that mixed media approach and I think it works, you know, because we are watching things differently. So I very much kind of wanted it to be an instruction manual or cookbook too, you know.
So folks in North Central West Virginia will instantly recognize some of these exterior scenes, I mean, especially, you know, Fairmont and Reedville. The Mon River is like a big character almost in the film. And I know you used our Morgantown studio for some of the interior car scenes. Where else did you shoot?
That was primarily, we did some pickup shoots. We did a lot of those in Morgantown in the months after we wrapped Principal. But primarily, other than one day down here, we primarily shot everything, you know, Reedsville, Fairmont. We kept it mostly in Marion County. And we shot in our grandparents' former house, which was an incredible opportunity and extremely surreal that we got to do that. But and the river was important to us. The river is a character in all our lives. The Mon is a super important piece of our childhood and of our family history, of everybody around here's history. And so I wanted it to be a character in the movie, too. So we wanted to stay as close to the river as we could. That must sound really weird, but it's true.
Yeah, well, it's a big part of life up here, but yeah.
You know, but it's funny when you talk about with the locations and we talk about relatability. And it was a lot of fun to be in West Virginia and to do it where it took place. But we had some screenings in in Pennsylvania, and a lot of folks immediately like, well, this looks kind of like here, but it's not, and where is it at? So we really had a lot of response to it of how interesting the environment looked like and where it was. And I think that you could even look at that when Lord of the Rings came out. People would watch it and go, where is that? Well, it's New Zealand. Well, we're not used to seeing a lot of New Zealand, and it fascinated people. And I think we had that a lot with folks too because of kind of the mixture of beautiful scenery melded in with industrial and the architecture of the towns and stuff. So I think that really popped with a lot of the viewers and a lot of people that saw it as well.
Jeff and Bob Tunnell, writer and director of Feast of the Seven Fishes, producer here in our studios, I really thank you for the time and the insight into this great film, and just well done on a great project. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
That was Jesse Wright speaking with Bob and Jeff Tennell about their new movie, Feast of the Seven Fishes. You can hear an extended version of their conversation on our website at wvpublic.org. Feast of the Seven Fishes is in select theaters and available on DVD, Blu-ray, and most streaming platforms.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Christmas. Just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten.
People have been decorating Christmas trees in their homes since the 16th century. It's a tradition that began in Germany and spread throughout Europe and the rest of the world. I remember decorating a Christmas tree in our house. We would always get the tree from this local grocery store. It was real and had been cut. One year, I remember feeling badly that we were killing at least one tree per year just for our enjoyment. So Dad found a place that sold trees that kept the roots. I was so excited to plant that tree at the edge of the mountainside by our house. Last I checked, it was still there. Dad would put up the tree and string the lights. He's probably the only one who had the patience to check and replace bulbs. Mom put on the garland, and us kids got to place our works of art on the tree. Of course, they inevitably landed in close clusters on the front of the tree, and one year, when we got home from Granny's house on Christmas Eve, the tree had fallen over from the weight of the ornaments. The lights were multicolored and the ornaments were sentimental and completely uncoordinated. Sometimes only one small strand would blink, but it was always beautiful. Today, many people use reusable artificial trees, but others still love the smell and sight of a real tree in their home. You can buy trees on retail lots or at farmers markets, but another option is going to a tree farm and picking out a tree just for yourself. Our producers, Eric Douglas and Roxy Todd, have both been spending some time talking to West Virginia farmers who grow Christmas trees. They got together to compare notes after they visited two farms in West Virginia, one in Kanawha County and the other in Upshur.
Hey, Eric.
Hi, Roxy.
So I understand you've been chopping down Christmas trees.
Well, chopping down may not be the word I would use. We saw them down. But yeah, no, I've been out at a local tree farm and there's just something cool about picking out your own Christmas tree and the smell of the pine and all that. It's a pretty fun experience.
I agree. I actually went a couple years when I was a kid, and what I remember was the hike out in the middle of the woods and then felt like so long and it was cold, but then they had hot chocolate back at the barn. So the whole experience stands out to me as a big adventure as a kid.
I think that's part of it for a lot of families is it's that adventure. It's getting out and making a day of it. I know the owner of the tree farm that I visited, Bob Wipke, mentioned that he has families come out and they'll literally bring a picnic with them and have lunch and pick out their tree and just make a whole day of it, make a whole experience out of it.
So tell me about the farm that you visit with your family.
The Wipke Tree Farm's not far from where I live. It's actually what Bob Wipke refers to as unusable land or had been unusable land. It's pretty steep hillside that he just goes through and plants trees every year, and he's been doing this for about 30 years now.
And it sounds really picturesque and beautiful, but I understand it's a ton of work.
It is a ton of work. There's a lot goes into it. It's not just something that you do for a couple weeks come Christmas time. It's a year-round process for preparing the trees.
The hardest time is in midsummer when it's the hottest, because here you have a window of about 1 month to shear all your trees. And you have to do it while the trees are in new growth. They're just putting on the new growth. The tree will set more buds to make it come thicker the next year, and it shapes the tree up.
Are there a lot of farms here in West Virginia that do this?
There are farms in West Virginia, but unfortunately the number is declining. I don't know that anybody knows exactly why, other than maybe just our farmers are getting older and getting out of the business. Actually, that's true with Bob Wipke as well. He said for age and for some health reasons, he's decided to close down his farm. He may have another year or two in it, but he's shutting things down.
Unfortunately, everybody's like me. They're getting old, and they're going out of business. And it's really happened the last 5 or 6 years. We did have over 150 growers in the state, and we're down to less than 90 now. And choosing cut growers like myself, there's only about 28, 30 of those in the whole state.
So, Roxy, West Virginia actually has about 12 million acres of forested land, but we don't have a lot of evergreens. As compared to actually the mountains in the Appalachian Mountains of North Carolina, where they grow 20% of the Christmas trees that are sold in the United States.
Wow.
I was amazed by that. Their numbers are pretty staggering.
So if you get a Christmas tree in, say, Ohio or Illinois, chances are it comes from North Carolina.
Yeah, they're shipping them all over the region. West Virginia actually only cuts about 43,000 trees each year. So you know we're literally 1% of the total of Christmas trees cut nationwide every year.
So when you first mentioned this story, I told you, well, I go out with my family every year and pick our tree. Why don't I bring my recorder with me? So I did. And it was great because it was an opportunity to talk with Ron Fowler, the owner of Fowler's Christmas Trees in French Creek up in Upshur County, West Virginia.
It's a very labor-intensive business.
Mr. Fowler is a retired forester, and he actually started this venture about 30 years ago thinking, oh, this will actually make me some money. This will allow my wife and I to do well in our golden years.
And I thought, if you put pencil to paper, I thought I was going to make a lot of money. Well, it didn't work out that way. It did not work out that way.
And his wife, Tilly Fowler, you know, she loves this work. She loves seeing the families. He kind of had to persuade her that this was a good idea. And now that they're getting up in years, they have some health issues, they're realizing that they're not going to be able to stop farming anytime soon.
Retirement's not an option, really. We still plan on being in business for several more years anyway.
So it's a lot of work, but Tilly says that they're actually doing pretty well if they can keep up with the work. There's a steady number of customers who want to pick their own Christmas trees.
We will probably have one of our best seasons this year.
Roxy, I think that's true. I think people are actually kind of going back to an attitude of, you know, this is something I did with my parents. This is something I did as a kid. And I want to instill that in my own family and create my own family traditions. So it almost feels like, at least the families I spoke to, it feels like it's growing. It feels like more young families are going out cutting their trees down. I actually talked to a young man named Cody Williams who was out with his family. He actually had a really interesting connection to his own father and why he wanted to start this tradition.
A couple of years ago, we actually dug up a picture of me and Dad cutting down a tree, and so I just decided that's something I definitely wanted to do with my kids.
Yeah, what he says there reminds me of something that I heard when I spoke with 20-year-old Sierra Linger. She was at the Fowler Christmas Tree Farm picking out a tree with her family.
Since I was little, me and I have two older siblings, we would always come every year, and each year a different kid got to pick the Christmas tree, and we get to cut it down and pick out our own and take it back and wrap it before we go decorate it.
So who picked the tree out this year?
Me.
And Sierra actually has an unusual strategy for picking out her Christmas tree.
I have a thing where when I first get out of the car, I try to pick out the tree that I want before I get to look at them. And then I go see if I'm right, and I did. So this is the very first one that I picked, and I thought it was the prettiest one. It was the greenest, and it smelled the best.
That's a great story. How did it work out for her? Did she find the one she was looking for?
She did. Yeah, they were carrying a massive-looking tree that I don't think I could carry on my own.
That sounds cool. So it sounds like she really enjoys going out and cutting down a tree.
She does, and she would like to keep cutting down trees for many years to come.
I love it. It's something that I want to continue to do when I get older, you know, get married, have kids. I want to come pick out the tree, and it's a big part of the Christmas tradition, and I really love it.
So, Roxy, you were out cutting down a tree for your family. How did that go for you?
Well, we haven't had our own personal Christmas tree in my family for a couple years because we had a new cat, and last year we had a new baby. But this year, my husband and I decided to cut our own tree. We picked out a little white pine, and my husband sawed it with his own bare hands while I held my one-year-old daughter.
Is it decorated and ready?
As of last night, yes. Kind of late to the game, but we strung out some Christmas lights. And now I realize the real challenge is we have to agree to disagree on the type of decorations we put up. I'm more of a colorful, lots of ornaments person. My husband, not so much. He likes the very simple white lights. So we have a little compromise.
Well,
we're working out.
Yeah, that's called married life, actually.
But I have to say, it was really fun to take my one-year-old daughter out in the woods. And there was this one moment where she was looking out over the ridgeline And our family had all scattered because they were all looking for their favorite tree. And she could see us all, and you could tell she felt like she was having an adventure out in the woods. And so I think this Christmas tree experience was one of my favorites.
You know, Roxy, I think that kind of sums it up, actually. It's the family, and it's the adventure, and kind of coming together and celebrating the holiday.
Well, happy holidays, Eric.
Merry Christmas to you.
As I've grown, holiday traditions have changed. The biggest change has probably been the addition of Hanukkah celebrations in my family. Yep, we celebrate both holidays these days. Sunday, December 22nd, marks the beginning of Hanukkah, the Jewish celebration of lights. Linda Pickholtz, Klein, and her father, Bob Pickholtz, both grew up Jewish in a Pittsburgh neighborhood called Squirrel Hill. When they sat down to record their story with StoryCorps, Bob Pickholtz shared this memory with his daughter about recreating new holiday traditions with Jewish and non-Jewish friends.
Well, I have many fond memories of going to the Paul Zedek Synagogue. I mean, that was the center of my religious life. And I still visit it every once in a while, and it's changed dramatically, but that still was a focus of my life, religiously.
What part of being Jewish play in your childhood?
Oh, I grew up in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. Went to a grade school that was predominantly Jewish students and non-Jewish teachers, which posed an interesting situation during the Christmas holidays. Because for one reason or another, we thought it was we weren't allowed to say the word Christ, and we just didn't do that. So we were supposed to sing Christmas songs, and we'd go, "Our Savior is born," and I'll never forget that.
Beyond public school being in a majority neighborhood, and because you and my mother stayed in Pittsburgh, I had that same opportunity, although I think more of my teachers were Jewish. So that wasn't quite the issue, I think, for me growing up in that same neighborhood, which is still a very sweet and Jewish neighborhood in the inner city in Pittsburgh,
yeah,
Pennsylvania.
Squirrel Hill. That's where the nuts come from.
Indeed. Many, many nuts come from there. What did it mean for you to be Jewish growing up there?
Nothing special, because it was the norm in my community, in my friendships.
And were most of your friends Jewish too?
Yes. Most of them were. I had a friend who was non-Jewish, and we used to like to go to his house at Christmas time, because he had a train that ran on tracks around the Christmas tree, and that was kind of special to us.
Other than the trains under the Christmas tree at non-Jewish friends, did you notice any other differences in those friends' families versus what your family did?
Not really.
Wow.
I think most families are the same no matter what.
Indeed. Indeed, indeed. And I also recall the interactions with non-Jews, particularly at Christmas time. We had our route that we went to the Turktogans, and we went to the Tezas, and we went to some other folks who had Christmas trees. Since you were tall, very often you were asked to put the star or the topper or whatever on the top of the tree. And for at least one of those trees, I think at the Tezas, they had a Jewish star.
Oh, yeah. We talked about the star, and I said, "Why don't you have a six-pointed star on your Christmas tree? Why a five?" And they said, "Well, we don't have a six-pointed star, but if we had one, we'd put it on a tree." So I went and took some welding rod and bent it in two triangles and soldered them together, and we put a six-pointed star on your Christmas tree.
And you got to put it up there.
And I got to put it up.
That's right.
That was Bob Pickholtz speaking with his daughter, Linda, back in 2016. We're sad to report that Mr. Pickholtz passed away several months ago. Their interview was recorded as part of the American Pilgrimage Project, a partnership of the National Nonprofit StoryCorps and Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. Their story was recorded in Charleston, West Virginia, and is archived in the Library of Congress. For our final story, we travel to a farm in Bluefield, Virginia, where a herd of music-loving goats gathers each Christmas to listen to the sound of carols being played on a church organ. I'm going to let Roxy Todd explain it from here.
There's a tradition in Appalachia of observing Old Christmas on January 6th. Folklore suggests that animals speak, so children are encouraged to go to bed early. But honestly, if someone told me that, I think I would try to sneak out and catch a glimpse of animals talking. But it turns out, you don't have to wait till January 6th to hear goats singing to Christmas carols. Yep, those are goats singing along to O Come All Ye Faithful. Connie Bailey Kitts is the owner of these musical goats and of the massive organ that the goats apparently love to listen to. The organ that Connie keeps at her farm dates back to the 1920s. Her family bought it about 50 years ago.
So my brother Daryl goes to my dad and he says, "How much do you think I should offer for the organ?" And my dad, being the local vet slash world-class horse trader, said, "Oh, I think you should offer maybe about $25 for it."
So the family bought the organ from a nearby church for $25.
And I don't know what the value of the organ was. I'm sure in the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars was probably the original value of the organ.
This is an enormous church organ we're talking about. There are actually more than 600 metal and wooden pipes, and they all play a different note. They move the organ to their family farm, and Connie's brother is a classically trained musician, so he'd play the organ at family gatherings, especially at Christmas. A few years ago, Connie's father passed away, and most of her family lives scattered across the country, so they rarely get to see each other these days. This year, her brother couldn't make the trip due to the weather. But Connie and her husband started a new tradition of inviting neighbors over to sing carols.
"Oh, we always do O Come, All Ye Faithful, because it sounds so majestic on the organ. And Joy to the World, of course. Then Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
That's Connie's neighbor, Susan Allen, playing the organ for a small gathering of children and adults. And there are animal fans of music who gather around the organ, too.
"Yeah, if they hear the music playing, they just immediately, they'll come down from the field when they hear the organ. And the organ's really, really powerful. If you open the door, you can hear it like, 300, 400 feet away from where it is. So it's got a really, really big sound, and they're drawn to it. Sometimes if the door's open, if they're outside, you can see them, they'll just lift their ears up like they're trying to catch more of the sound of the organ. I think they don't know quite what to make of it. And then when you open the door, they don't hesitate at all to go in. And the sound of the organ, it doesn't intimidate them either. It's just amazing."
Connie also runs a small Airbnb, which at times does attract guests from as far away as Russia. She had a guest a few years ago who plays percussion for the Moscow Philharmonic, and he sat down to play the organ and entertain the goats. But the goats actually don't seem to mind who's playing the organ. They just love the music. Here they are singing along as one of Connie's neighbors, Jim Bartlett, plays Joy to the World. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd. We've posted a few photos of Connie's musical goats, who are named Cinnamon, Piano, Percy, and Sledge, on our website. Check it out. They literally crowd right around whoever is playing the organ. See them at wvpublic.org. What a beautiful image. Music, outdoors, and animals. There seems to be a little Christmas magic in there, too. I hope to go check it out someday. It reminds me that Christmas and the holidays isn't just about presents, but about meeting up with people you love and enjoying time together. So this holiday season, may you experience the spirit in many ways, even if it's just a simple gesture, smile, or song. Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Our theme music is by Matt Jackfert. Our music this week was provided by Richie Collins, Vince Guaraldi, who plays piano on the Charlie Brown Christmas album, and Bob Thompson. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Kara Lofton edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu. ¶¶